Hey everyone, welcome to the Grief Informed Podcast. I'm your host, Rachel Garcia, and this is a place where I bring you authentic conversations with people who are willing to share their journey through seasons of grief. No matter your cultural upbringing, societal conditioning, or faith practice, grief affects us all. Whether you're dealing with a loss, a diagnosis, a broken heart, or the everyday stressors of life, or love someone who is, these conversations are here to support you in that process. So be sure to check out the show notes for potential trigger warnings. And whether you're very comfortable with or deeply avoidant of grief and its many responses, you are welcome here. Thank you for being here, and now on to the episode. Hey everyone, thank you for joining the Grief Informed Podcast. I'm your host, Rachel Garcia, and I'm excited that you're here. And I'm really excited about the conversation that I'm going to have today. I have Janice Johnson, and Janice is a social worker, author, speaker, mother, and recovering alcoholic, helping recovering individuals repair their relationships with their family and friends. And I am so grateful that you're here. Welcome, Janice.
Thank you for having me. I am really grateful to be here, too.
I am mostly grateful that you, being from Daphne, Alabama, make it magically to Birmingham once a month, and therefore we could record in person instead of remotely. That was really exciting, and I could bring you to the quietest room in this house,
which is the wonderful studio you have
yes,
created.
Yes, please talk about that. Yeah, this amazing studio in my bedroom. Sitting on my I'm sitting on my daughter's chair from her desk. And is likely the quietest. There are more teenagers here tonight than I gave birth to. But they will probably not be the source of the most disruption. It will be the cat. But I did have a podcast episode where he literally sat outside the door, and I'm texting a teenager while recording, can you please come get this cat? I can hear him in the, I'm not telling y'all which one, but it's, the cat is definitely in there. But I think that he will be happy right now. But anyway, glad you're here.
Thanks for having me. The cat didn't seem to like me much, though, when I came in the front door.
He's just not social. I don't, the kids give him enough drama that I don't think he can handle any other kind of stimulation from strangers.
And let me back up a minute and say that's not a reflection of my personality.
No, not at all.
I am a dog person.
You had a
dogs
dog scent.
Love
that was,
me.
Yeah. Cats don't love anybody. I'm learning. This is my first cat. But, yeah, he doesn't like anybody but us. So it's very interesting. And some of us he likes less than others. I won't name names. But anyway, I am glad you're here. And I do, before we dive in, can you tell us about your cultural upbringing and background?
Yes. And I have to say,
yeah,
I think this is such a great question that you ask everyone, because I don't think people realize just how important our early childhood development impacts us as adults.
Yes. Yeah.
So,
and I will give credit where credit is due. That comes from Lacey Phillips over at To Be Magnetic, of her podcast. She does that, and I loved it. And I was like, if I ever have a podcast, I'm going to ask that. So,
good. It is. It's a great question. So, well, my dad was a functioning alcoholic, but from the outside of our, if you were to look at our family, you would think we were just like every other middle class family in my neighborhood.
Yeah.
My mom primarily stayed home with the kids. My dad worked. I have two older brothers. We were all at had different levels of success in different things.
Yeah.
And you would have looked at the Johnson household and went, oh, they're nice people. But my dad was an alcoholic, and my mom was an adult child of an alcoholic. Mm-hmm. Both my parents had alcoholism in their family history. And that deeply impacted me as a child. I mean, there's a whole field of study about codependency in adult children of alcoholics. Mm. And I, without getting into all that, I definitely fit that bill. And I emerged from that family very much an adult child of an alcoholic, insecure, low self-esteem, people pleaser, afraid of authority figures, afraid of conflict. And then compound that with, or I'm jumping ahead a little bit.
No,
but
that's fine.
Some of the family, the characteristics of our family, which was we didn't have big blowout fights that often, I take that back. My parents didn't have big blowout fights because as kids, we were not allowed to question authority.
Right. Yeah. And you're stepping all over my toes because I also am an adult child of an alcoholic or recovering alcoholic. My dad as well. So all of that sounds so incredibly familiar.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the second question I was going to ask you is, do you know your Enneagram number?
I am an Enneagram 6.
All right. Yeah, my oldest son is a 6. Tell me what you know and how that informs you from what you and what you've read.
Well, the thing I identify most with it is that, I guess the characteristic or trait, and correct me because you probably know more about this than I do, is that I'm the loyalist.
Uh-huh.
Is that the right way to say
it? Yeah.
And I truly am, but that's the positive side of a 6. The negative side of the 6 is that I have a lot of fear and fear of abandonment, rejection, which is exactly what I experienced as a kid in my household. I struggle with self-confidence. What else can you tell me about myself?
Well, I just realized in my fog that I said that my oldest son is a 6. He is not. He misidentified him with some of the numbers that are very similar, but he's a 3. But I know a 6. I know several 6s. And the 6s in stress go...
It's anxiety, worry.
Yeah, go to that. But in growth, there's the 9 becomes 9 and becomes very... go with the flow and able to relax a little bit with all the way that I know the 6, the loyalist, yes, but they thrive on plan A, plan B, plan C. I need to have a contingency for all of the things. And so you're nodding your head in agreement.
Absolutely. I'm the most controlling person I know.
Yeah. Because it comes from a fear of not being prepared, not being prepared for this situation. And if you have an outcome for every situation, you're set. And as long as all your contingencies go the way that you want, but heaven forbid, life become chaos. And then it becomes a sense of worry, but the practice is to go back into that 9, to go back into that surrender, into that trust and that releasing of control. That track.
That's perfect. And I just want to share this because I had an aha moment this morning when I was driving to Birmingham because I have a lot going on this week. Yeah. And which normally, again, I am a 6, so I stress. I overplan, overprepare for everything.
Yeah.
But I found myself when I was talking to my son today, I go, you know what? I'm going to turn all that energy just into excitement and enthusiasm for all the stuff that I got going on. It's exciting. Yeah. Coming, doing a podcast with you in person is exciting.
Oh, I love that.
You know? So, yeah.
I love that shift. That's a good...
That's what I'm working on.
A great...
One of the many things I'm working on. So. Yeah,
I appreciate you sharing that. Thank you. Yeah. Okay, so... Knowing a little bit about you, tell us how you got into the work that you are doing now. What started this journey for you?
Well, I like my story. It's kind of a full circle story.
Okay.
So I was raised in that alcoholic home, being a people pleaser, a nurturer, taking care of people. But I also carried that alcoholic gene.
Yeah.
So I didn't know if I should jump into this yet. I experimented with alcohol and drugs as a adolescent college student, but you know what? I was too controlling. I didn't like the feeling I got. So instead of becoming an alcoholic, I became a social worker.
I'm so good. I have so many questions. How did we jump? Okay. From what I know of social work, the joke would be you'd want to drink. Like you'd want to have the stress level of that. What brought you there?
Well, that's a great point.
The caretaking. I mean, it had to be the caretaking.
It is the caretaking and being able to handle drama and stress. My last, not my last social work job, but my most dramatic stress, which a lot of people would say is stress-filled. When my kids were little, I worked as a social worker at the University of South Alabama's Doctor and Women's Hospital. Children and Women's Hospital, called Doctors. And I covered the emergency room and the NICU, ICU. Wow. So I saw all of the child abuse, sexual abuse cases.
Wow.
Everything. But you know what? Not a problem for me.
Really?
I can cope with other people's drama.
Yeah.
So as a social worker, it filled a niche. I mean, I was used to like drama, chaos, trying to be analytical, how to solve problems for people, how to turn this into a better situation. And a lot of people have asked me, we're way off track here, but a lot of people ask me, like, how did you cope with that? And I'm like, well, 9 out of 10 cases have happy endings.
Oh, that's great.
And of those last case, you're still going to make it better for someone here on out. And
yeah,
focused on that.
I think that's I think that's using your six strength of the being able to come up with a plan in the middle of chaos. That's the best part of being a six.
Yeah.
You were perfect for that. Okay, go on.
There we go. But my first jobs at a school, well, let me back up again. So my coping mechanism as a kid for my chaotic family life, which I have to say wasn't crazy. It was just confusing. My parents had good intentions. They were good people.
Yeah.
They just passed on the same intergenerational trauma that had been passed on to them. And that's a whole nother story.
Right.
So, but my coping mechanism was sports as a kid.
Oh, okay.
And sports gave me direction, guidance, and kept me off the alcohol and drugs too, and earned me a college scholarship.
Oh, there you go.
And,
which sport?
Synchronized swimming.
Get out!
Which is now called artistic swimming.
Oh, I love that.
Thank you.
Can I send you funny memes that I see?
You can. Okay. Because for the probably first 10 years out of college, I was angry at Saturday Night Live for making fun of us.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's okay.
I've opened a wound. I'm so sorry.
It is an odd sport.
It is amazing, though, the strength to hold yourself and move and dance underwater and through water that I can't.
All by holding your breath.
I can't. So. I bow to you. That is amazing.
Bless you. Thank
that
you.
That is amazing.
Thank you. On behalf of all.
Yes.
Artistic swimmers everywhere.
Yes, yes, yes.
Thank you for that.
Amazing.
But anyhow, that sent me far away from college. I mean, far away from home.
Yeah.
I grew up in Texas, went to Michigan for school. And my parents were like, just graduate. So I took all the courses that interested me. I got involved in internships and psychology research projects. I mean, I love studying. I still love studying, which is how my book, which we'll talk about later, evolved.
Yeah.
And it just came naturally. I was drawn to psychology and social work. You can't do much with an undergraduate degree in psychology. So I went straight to graduate school. And then still, I had to pay my way through that. So I worked as a research assistant and a teaching assistant for a couple different professors, one of them who specialized in addiction. And it just made sense for me to step. My first jobs out of college were in addiction.
Yeah.
I was not an alcoholic or addict at that time.
Yeah.
I probably was an addict, but I had socially acceptable addictions of like, because I was super still into training from swimming. It went to triathlons.
Yeah.
You know, and my approach was definitely addictive, but no one's going to complain about like.
Yeah. Exercising too much.
4 hours on Saturday.
Right, right.
At a race.
Yeah.
So I stepped right into working in treatment centers. Wow. And I worked on the family side, which was great. It made sense. I can say this now, but in my 20s, I was often confused for teenagers.
Yeah.
So I was a great counselor with adolescents. And because I didn't have children, I could say to parents, well, I could preach the tough love.
Yeah.
You know, if your kid's going to die, if you keep enabling him this way or her this way. So anyhow, it came natural. To make a long story short, I worked in that field for a while, kind of moved my way up. I worked at a couple of great addiction centers, some inpatient, some outpatient. Then I met and married my husband and followed his career. And then that's when I got into more medical social work and outpatient counseling, things like that.
Yeah.
And much less demanding jobs, less call, things like that. And then I was a stay-at-home mom for a little while.
Yeah.
like got involved with the school that my kids did, Catholic Social Services and the Red Cross. So I stepped away from intensive social work for a while. And also by doing that, I stepped away from my self-care. Yeah. I don't know if you experienced this or anyone out there. I have four kids. You have four kids.
Yeah. Yeah.
So all of those good self-care activities I had in my 20s.
Yeah.
Like running every day, going to Al-Anon meetings or ACA meetings. There's not much time when you have
four kids.
Mm-hmm. Your kids are much closer, but there wasn't much time. And my now ex-husband traveled for his job. So I felt like a single mother.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I, again, being a six, taking care of everyone else, a good codependent, stopped taking care of myself, started drinking.
Yeah.
And became an alcoholic.
And you, which you said, I heard you on a podcast say that it didn't start out that way. You were drinking socially. You were with your friends drinking. But then the difference is when everybody left, you kept drinking.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and in the truth, the first couple of years, because it was in my early 40s, because I spent my 30s pregnant or breastfeeding.
Yeah.
And I did start drinking very socially at first.
Yeah.
It gradually increased over time. It wasn't, there wasn't a switch. But I firmly believe in the genetic predisposition. And I tell my kids this all the time, but I'm like, you probably have my genes.
Yeah.
And I think if you put enough alcohol into a broken system, you're going to become an alcoholic.
Okay.
Just like my mother and every one of her siblings who smoked has had lung cancer.
Yeah.
I can't say there's a genetic predisposition.
Right. But do you want to test
cancer?
It?
Yeah.
I don't want to test that.
Anyhow, yeah. I went to treatment. Before treatment, I had, I was working with Catholic Social Services. Went to treatment, continued to damage my family. Mm-hmm. That's a whole nother story, which is on other podcasts.
Yeah.
And it took me a while to repair those relationships. When I finally got to the other side of that, it became my purpose. My mission is to help other families, which that's the whole first circle thing. I started out helping families from the codependent side. Then I became an alcoholic. And now I'm trying to reach out to other alcoholics to teach them, help them repair the relationships with their friends and family members. Because here's the big moral of the story. Lots of years of training and education.
Yeah.
I went into treatment and all of that went out the window. Mm. All the stuff that I knew, all of the ACA Al-Anon meetings I'd been to years before, I still went to treatment and I made the same rookie mistakes other recovering people make.
Yeah.
So.
Well, there was a difference between you had studied it, but now you'd lived it.
Yeah.
You were having the lived experience of that material and could see and probably very compassionately understand now at a level you may not have been able to tap into beforehand.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So when I reached out to you, I asked you the first phone call we had, I said, so the podcast is about grief and I want to talk about how, you know, your story navigating grief through recovery, through the repair. And I asked you, so what was happening at the time that you became an addict? What was it in your life that it switched from I'm doing this thing to socially to that awareness that I might be avoiding or numbing something?
Mm-hmm.
And you were like, yeah, I did have something going on at the time. What was going on?
Okay. Yeah. So, both of my parents got sick at the same time and my parents still lived in Texas. I lived in Alabama and I spent about 6 months spending equal amount of time in Texas trying to get my parents healthy and back on track. My mom had had a hip replacement go bad. She coded, ended up in rehab in a nursing home. My father, who had a moderate stage of Alzheimer's at the time, fell, hit his head, had a brain bleed, ended up in ICU. Literally when my mom's like the day after she codes in the hospital.
Wow.
I calling 911 to come pick him up. Anyhow, I had a traumatic summer and 6 months trying to help heal my parents. Mm. Here's the big catch. So growing up in my family, my parents never taught us about how to deal with emotions, much less grief,
yeah,
or conflict. And I had, except for the fact that we moved around a lot as a child, I hadn't had any huge loss experiences, I don't want to minimize the loss of my dog or
right.
grandparents, but I had never learned how to deal with grief.
Yeah.
My dad, I knew that he had been diagnosed with Alzheimer's. Mm-hmm. I had a lot of feelings about that I was avoiding, neglecting, dismissing because of the childhood
yeah.
situation I grew up in. So when he hit his head and ended up in the hospital and they asked me, your dad's 80 years old. He's got Alzheimer's. We can just let him die peacefully.
Mm.
I was like, no.
Yeah.
What do you mean? And so I made a decision for him to have surgery, and he survived that incident. But over the course of the next 6 months, his life was hell.
Mm.
And we had a couple more incidents of life and choice situations where I had to choose, get this treatment to extend your life or go into hospice. And the third time I picked hospice. All of this time, extremely stressed,
yeah,
all alone. My kids are primarily in Alabama. I'm primarily in Texas.
Yeah.
And my way of coping with it was drinking.
Yeah.
I was all alone.
Yeah.
And this is when I remember I started day drinking. I would be sitting by my dad's bed in the hospital room and had vodka in my fruit juice drink. And that's how I coped. And that to me was the big turning point. My not knowing how to deal with my grief. I think I'm the poster child for
not. I got you. Look, you can't claim that. That's not fair.
Well, I mean,
I'm still in the running. No, just go ahead.
I mean, and not managing your grief well.
Right, right.
Yeah. So I did not manage my grief well. I drank.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was probably the biggest turning point to where from, the next 6 years, it was circling the toilet bowl.
Yeah.
So.
Because at that point, you're not aware that you're not managing your grief. You're just thinking, no. I'm drinking too much. It's not aware. It's like I cannot remember who said this, but I learned this from a recovery group that was mm-hmm. saying, we have a tree and we have branches of behavior that pop mm-hmm. out that are basically our coping of what we use to not dive into the roots. And until we dive into the roots to figure out what's bringing up those branches, and we could cut one off, but another one's going to grow in its place, or it'll grow back until right. we deal with the health of the roots. And the roots are what are we avoiding? What are mm-hmm. we trying to numb through the alcohol, through the shopping, through the food, through the extreme exercise, through all of those things?
Mm-hmm.
What are we trying to numb? So when did you make that connection to, okay, I can stop the behavior? You probably go into the recovery groups, but when do you face the grief?
Oh my gosh. Well, so when I went to treatment, I mean, it was all over. Like, part of me was blaming my alcoholism on my death of my dad. That's just denial. So right. let's just go there.
Okay.
But part of it's very legitimate. So I was offered the opportunity to do an intensive grief group 3 hours a day for, I don't remember if it's, I think it was just 5 days.
Yeah.
And that released me of the guilt over my dad, of letting my dad live, of choosing to let him die. That helped substantially. Yeah. And that group was very gestalt. Are you familiar with that?
No.
A lot of role play, acting out.
Okay, yeah.
Physically working through.
Yeah.
It was great. It was great. And I was clearly better.
Yeah.
But I knew I still had work to do. So, yeah, that was on my to-do list of recovery things.
Yeah.
Once I left treatment.
Was
to continue to work on grief, those issues. Because I showed you early the grief recovery handbook, yes. And I'm just going to skip ahead.
And I'll link that into the show notes too for that book.
I love this book.
Yeah.
I've learned a lot of things from it. Well, so leave treatment. I focus on sobriety. I table the grief because there's bigger issues to deal with first, which is maintaining sobriety. And made a mess of my family for a while, which is what the book's about. Once we started getting better. So I got sober in 2013, went through that group in 2013. In 2016, my closest childhood friend was diagnosed with a terminal brain tumor.
Wow.
And for the first 6 months of that, I did exactly like I'd done with my dad's Alzheimer's. Denial, minimization, call her, talk to her from a distance. She lived in California. I live in Alabama.
Yeah.
Avoid.
Yeah.
And tell, pretend that she was going to get better until I finally, I don't know if it was my therapist or my sponsor, it's like, you got to go visit this woman. Yeah. You're acting out. I didn't drink. So I did get to say goodbye to her. I did get to be of service to her family towards the end of her life. But that triggered all that grief all over again.
Yeah.
And so my therapist, I'm a big proponent of therapy, whether you get it online or in person, was like, I've got a friend who does this intensive grief therapy group that I think you'd be perfect for. And it's based on this handbook, which is, as I said before, it's more exercises, activities. It's not as much therapy. You're not going into deep exploration of,
right.
But it's like practical ways of learning to deal with your grief. And I went through that and that made, it's wonderful. It's a great.
One of them pop out in your mind right now?
Okay. Yeah. So one of the exercises was making a timeline. And on the timeline, you write down all the significant losses and experiences of grief. You rank them. You put your age. I mean, and just visualizing that and you seeing, you go, well, it's no wonder I can't handle this. Because, look, my family moved. I went to 4 different schools in 4 years.
Right.
That's a loss that no one ever dealt with. Those little things by itself, my parents, I'm sure, were like, they're kids. But you do that. Over and over again, it fuels the bigger losses.
Yeah.
So then when you toss in the loss of a pet that no one helped you resolve, the loss of a grandparent, yada, yada.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it can be. So in 2017, went through that group. I have to say, I'm really honest about this, is that grief is one of my core issues that I still have to deal with, and I still address, and I still make myself accountable. My kids will tell you I don't cry except for when someone dies.
Really?
Yeah.
Even joy? Will you cry tears of joy?
I take that back. Last time I didn't cry at my own son's wedding, but I cried at one of my best friend's daughter's wedding.
Oh yeah.
So it's very unpredictable, but I don't cry out of sadness very often over death, and that's to me a sign that there's still work to do there.
I cry all the time and there's still work to do, so it's the same for either expression or response of that. I would never want anybody listening to, because I've had friends say the same thing to me, that I just don't cry. And I'm like, there's no shame in that. It's okay. Right. Be where you are right now. Let your nervous system be where it is, because it's protecting you for a reason. And you can acclimate into that slowly. Like, it doesn't have to be let me dive into all of my stuff all at one time. It can be incremental. Again, knowing that numbing, it's all coming from numbing and avoiding.
Right.
Like you mentioned with your friend and not wanting to go see her, to be able to face that reality.
Mm-hmm.
And knowing that you weren't taught, you said you weren't taught how to be with the reality of chaos or reality of these losses and how to express or emote from them. It can be a shock to the system when you realize you do have things, when you're looking at that timeline going, wow, wait a second, no wonder why I struggled. I was only a kid when I experienced mm-hmm. this. And the same thing happened. I was in a conversation with my kids. We were driving somewhere and we were talking about the podcast, and one of my kids, they'll all go nameless for this, but said, you know, well, I would like to come on your podcast, but I really don't have anything like grief to talk about. And the face you just made, my child that was driving turned, like, just looked and was like, what the heck are you talking about? Hello, divorce.
Yeah.
And they were like, well, I just don't think it's affected me that much. And we literally, I just started asking questions, and they started, and like, it was a podcast episode just for us. Uh-huh. And I was like, they started talking about it, and they were, and just hearing each of their perspectives of how they each approached it, but they were willing to and able to share, like, oh, okay, this part was hard. Oh, I do remember when, and they just started sharing things. But it was almost like a shock to one of them, yeah. that they could have grief because their parents were divorced, because there's this sense of like comparative suffering. Well, if it's not as bad as this other person, or like minimizing, mm-hmm. you mentioned minimizing, if it's not as bad as this other person, or it could be so much worse, or mm-hmm. I'm, if you're very compassionate, you've seen in social work experiences that you would think, I can't imagine anybody, you know, making it through that. We would all have that. But to recognize for ourselves what it's like to process our world and what it's been like for us, I think is the beginning of that shift in perspective, that it's our side of the street that we're assessing, and having an honest, compassionate look at what have I experienced and what might I be avoiding? What might I be numbing? What might I be unwilling to look at or not wanting to look at, which is so very common, whether it's alcoholism or any area of our life where we're numbing.
And kind of trauma, early trauma, adult trauma, chronic.
Yeah. And I hear from people all the time, like I hear them say, well, I didn't have any major trauma. My childhood was relatively, you know, normal. And yet we could look and like you could peel back and just find pain points. There were places in your life where you experienced messaging or thoughts, inner critic, you know, ways that you were talked to that were limiting to you that would create pain that you might have to grieve. And in a lot of ways, even for me, being able to recognize what I might be avoiding is the first step, that awareness.
Right.
I can share a personal example of that. After my divorce, I was, it was like the first 3 years, I had this very extroverted reality of like, I took one of my primary core values is adventure. So I loved to travel. I would, you know, my kids go to their dad's house 2 weekends out of the month. On those weekends, I would be up north kayaking in a river or down at the beach sitting at the beach, and love that world. But there was a one weekend in particular where all of my plans got canceled. I couldn't be around anybody. I wasn't able to socialize, which I was so dependent on, and so dependent on go, 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 mm-hmm. that the moment that was taken away from me, I, as the Gottmans have said, that whenever you experience something, a response that's a triggering response and it seems hysterical, that means it's historical. Yeah. You are aware. Yeah. So I had a very historical response that weekend that was quite shocking to me in the awareness of, why do I have such a hard time being home?
Yeah.
And I realized in that moment there was a deeper wound there of, I was not processing grief about the home that I'm in, that is the home that I was married in and mm-hmm. now divorced and chose to keep. And chose, it was like I was minimizing it. Well, I chose to stay here. It makes better financial sense. But yet there was some very real pain associated with being here that I hadn't felt. What were you going to say?
I was going to say, and without your kids.
And I had gotten used to them. But yes, no, when I first was, it was very difficult to be by myself, which I think was a lot of why I was just going mm-hmm. with other people. You were absolutely right. But I would enjoy the break, but also be very afraid to be alone. Mm-hmm. And so I took that realization to go, wait a second, this isn't healthy. If I'm having, I need to dive in there. Why am I avoiding this? And then I had the courage to, as you do with recovery, to be able to go, let me face this. What do I do to remedy this? What do I do to bring healing to this? Because I'm out of balance. That's And so the answer to that for me was being able to be by myself, to reclaim parts of my home and to grieve and to repurpose and also just learning to be by myself. So it's not just in alcoholism. There's all of us are struggling to name and face places that are very difficult because do we have the skill set and the support to get through it? So you decided to go into recovery. You're doing this grief work. And then you have the issue of repair with your family. So tell me about what that process started to look like for you.
Okay. So I made, I made the first big mistake I made was thinking that if I just got sober, that would help heal
everybody.
The family.
Yeah.
Which is just wrong. Because I denied and minimized my kids' experiences with having an alcoholic mom.
Yeah.
So that was the first mistake. The next mistake was I didn't communicate with my family very well about my treatment needs. And part of that was because I fear of abandonment, fear of rejection. I didn't want them to fight back or to argue. I mean, I remember one of the first conversations I had with my oldest son who was in college at the time. And I'm like, I'm calling to tell you I'm in treatment. And I remember him asking me, well, how long are you going to be there? And why are you there? And the kids all knew I was struggling. I had been going to AA and trying to get sober. And I felt this like huge sense of like, oh my God, I'm not taking care of my family at home.
Yeah.
And to deal with that, to numb that, I just threw myself more into the recovery program. Mm. So needless to say, I made a lot of mistakes. Part of it was because treatment was a long way from home. My family's in Mobile, down by Mobile. Treatment was north of Birmingham. Part of it was that I went from 4 weeks of treatment to 12 weeks of inpatient treatment because I opened up a lot of wounds, the grief, some other PTSD stuff. And then I ended up going to a halfway house out of that after that and then a sober living house. So I essentially abandoned my family and saying that the harshest way, I think that's probably my children's impression of it.
Yeah.
Because I didn't communicate to them why I was doing what I was doing. I was just like, this is what they recommend.
Yeah.
I have to do this to stay sober without any good feedback, any communication, all my childhood stuff. So I made a lot of mistakes in the first 2 years of recovery at about, I would say my eyes opened up at like at 6 months of sobriety. Mm. And when I finally realized that I had further damaged my relationships with my now ex-husband and my kids.
Yeah.
And some of my extended family and friends too. I just cut all those people out of my life. And I had to go back to the drawing board and start working on. And it was trial and error. It was talking to the old timers in the meetings. It was talking to my friends' kids, my friends in recovery, their kids, actually interviewing them and being like, how come you get along with your mom and my kids don't get along with me anymore? Yeah. I mean, just doing everything I could and then putting my social work hat back on and reading every book I could. And trial and error, we finally figured it out.
What'd you figure out?
Well, I figured out, This is key, is you've got to maintain sobriety.
Yeah.
And but you got to find a balance between taking care of your sobriety needs and your family's needs. And 30 years ago when I was the social worker on the family side and I would fight with the inpatient treatment when I was a family program therapist, not fight, but I would bicker with the therapist. I'd be like, your patients need to understand what their family members are thinking about too.
Yeah.
I mean, I knew this 30 years ago.
Sure.
I just forgot it
when
it came to myself. So is it, so the keys, the first keys are awareness.
Yeah.
communication, finding the balance, brutal honesty.
Yes.
I mean, relapse is really common with us.
Yeah.
I personally am not shocked or horrified when a friend, a sponsee, goes back out and drinks.
Yeah.
I'm always happy when they come back in.
Sure.
I think there's a good way and a bad way for us as recovering people to address that with our families. And most importantly, you got to be honest.
Yeah.
I could tell some lovely stories about people who did it right.
Yeah.
You know, and family yeah. members who got it. And we'll tell the story. So I have a home group meeting down in Daphne. And there's a guy who's been in and out a few times. And he came back in. And they call it picking up a silver chip.
Yeah.
When you have had a slip, relapse, off the wagon, whatever you want to call it. And he picked up a silver chip. And he was like, my wife told me I had to come back. And he described how the day before he'd had a bender.
Yeah.
He doesn't know why. They didn't know why it triggered him, but he drank and started drinking, like left work with the guys or something, came home, and his wife looked at him and went, just looked at him, made eye contact. It was like, you're going to a meeting tomorrow.
Yeah.
And that was it.
Yeah.
And he came to a meeting. I mean, and, you know, I continue to see him. He's doing good. His relationship with his wife is good. The point was that he didn't try to deny or minimize. He's like, you're right, I screwed up.
Yeah.
I'm going to try again tomorrow.
Yeah.
So I think that honesty is really important. I mean, every one of my kids, and I think most family members will ask their alcoholic or addict when they come home, promise me or tell me you'll never drink again.
Yeah.
And you can't make that promise.
Right.
As addicts and alcoholics, my book is full of like do's and don'ts and myths and things like that.
Yeah.
We've made so many promises in the past, and a new promise is not going to be, they're not going to believe it for one. You have to do the work. You have to show it.
Yeah.
And what I said to my kids, because it still comes up. I mean, it comes up from time to time where one of my kids will go, well, my daughter said this to me. I can't even remember the specific time, but she looked at me and she goes, it would just kill me if you ever drank again. And she's one of my biggest supporters now. She was one of my harshest critics at one point.
Yeah.
But, and I looked at her and I said, you know what, Katie, I am sober today. I'm pretty sure tomorrow I'm going to do all the same things today that I do, which I am very, I'm some good healthy rituals to keep me sober, prayer, meditation, inventories, talking to my sponsor. I said, I'm pretty sure I'll be sober again tomorrow. I mean, that's all I can really promise them. And I think that's, you can't underestimate the value of that.
Right. That honesty, but also the honesty of her to be able to say, I don't know that I'd be okay if you did this.
Mm-hmm.
And that, and knowing too, what I know about a codependent tendency or stance is the hardest part for me learning was the you're not okay, I'm okay.
Mm-hmm.
And if this isn't okay, I can still be okay. But that process of her learning how to be with the heaviness of that and the heaviness of the reality is it would hurt. It would really hurt for that to happen for you, I know. But also, I know that there is support available. I mean, it makes me think of how my dad, recovering alcoholic, when I was in high school, and he was dealing with his numbing of pain of losing my mother and her dying. And it's like, I can have compassion for that, but I also had to help him get out of the truck at night when he, you know, times where he'd passed out in the truck and bring him back inside, or I'd had to watch him not come to my basketball games, you know, because of his own alcoholism. And as an adult, I still grieve. That was so incredibly painful and impacts my world today, but there's healing even today. So you're being responsible and honest about, hey, I'm here today. I've got this tomorrow. And her also being honest of, I don't know that I could handle it.
Right.
And okay, we're just honest.
It is. And the thing is, from a recovering person's point of view, we're used to quick fixes.
Yeah.
Quick answers, trying to numb our feelings.
Yeah.
This is a long-term process. It was 18 months before I saw any, I was 18 months sober. So a year after I had my wake up moment, before I saw progress with any of my kids. And it was 4 years until I could say I saw progress with the last one.
Yeah.
And it is a long term. We have to deal with, I had to deal with my, I was getting rejected. Yeah. By my kids. I had to deal with it. I had to take it to therapy, work on it.
Well, yeah. And because of the chaos that creates, it's like another trigger point for how do you cope with that, with that level of rejection.
Yeah.
Constantly from, especially when you're trying to make amends and that brings up grief work. So in the recovery process for you, I mean, it sounds like grief is apparent all the time. Like you're having to navigate. If you were talking to somebody who is just coming into that awareness of, I may be numbing or this might be a problem, what would you recommend for them?
Well, don't keep it a secret. Tell someone. Because holding that pain is going to eat you alive. But are you talking about someone who's in active, who's numbing through alcohol or drugs, or who's
sure, let's
sober?
Go. We could either... We got time. You can give me both. Yeah. I mean, let's say with drugs and alcohol, let's say somebody's like, okay, I think I might have a problem here.
Well, okay. So this is a great question. It may contradict what I just said, but I really think if you are problematically drinking or using alcohol or drugs or have crossed that line to addiction to numb your feelings, you're going to have to table those feelings. You're going to have to work on getting sober first and build the foundation. And I say that for two reasons. One, because dealing with those feelings, walking through them, you know, is incredibly painful and trigger producing. If you don't have a good foundation of sobriety, you're going to go right back to drinking.
Right.
Drinking or drugging or gambling, whatever it is you use to numb with.
Yeah.
So let's build a foundation of skills to keep you sober.
Right.
During that time. And I also am a big proponent of believing in the disease model of addiction. I firmly believe that walking through the steps of the broken brain disease model, I believe that addiction is a physical disease as well. There's a disease component to addiction.
Right.
There, your brain adapts, the dopamine, the neurotransmitters, all of those, the normal processes get disrupted by the introduction of alcohol, drugs, or a numbing behavior.
Right.
Once you stop the alcohol or drugs, your brain
has to recover.
It is craving. This is why the foundation is so important. It is craving, trying to find that balance that you used to like get by putting in drugs. So, or alcohol. And it takes time for neuroplasticity, for the rebuilding, for the receptors to revive. And during that time, it's not a great time to deal with trigger issues.
Sure.
So
it's got to be a calm nervous system too before you can. I mean, that's grief work. And that's one of the reasons why I want to have the conversations on the podcast is for people. We're not having a deep dive every podcast in the sense of let's talk to you listeners, let's navigate your grief. It's more of you being able to hear other people's experiences and go, oh, that's how grief shows up. And it just brings a ping of awareness. Mm-hmm. But definitely you can't tackle these bigger, deeper issues until you have a solid base, until you have a solid nervous system or your brain is healthy, your body's healthy. All of those things come first. It's those primary needs first, and those emotional needs will get met with a skill set. And it will land, it will resonate, it will keep when you can heal that the body first, and then be able to excavate into what's causing you to want to numb and harm. So that makes perfect sense.
Yeah. Yes, you described that beautifully.
Oh, well, I mean, it's like I had to learn that. I remember years my therapist, God love her, Becky. Becky with the good hair. She she literally would, for years in talk therapy, go, hey, Rachel, you keep mentioning these, like, my traumatic experiences that seem like, to the normal person, your therapist taking the notes, these are big events. But when we bring them up, you kind of scoot them over, mm-hmm. and I don't really want to talk about them. I really think that you would benefit with EMDR therapy. And I was like, no, ma'am. Well, first of all, I said no out of the gate before I knew fully what it was. That's just classic me. And then she was like, yeah, this is what we do, but we dive into those without the emotional response because of the stimulation that we're providing and rapid eye movement or hands. You hold something that vibrates in either hand, activating the right and left brain. Your emotional center of the brain is offline, so you can go in and dive into these. You know, it's the EMDR is what we use in PTSD recovery. And my word, I said no. I said no for like 2 or 3 years. Yeah. And then the year that I finally did it, and I had years of foundation of talk therapy under my belt. But when we did the EMDR, it was the single biggest catalyst of helping me know how to calm from a calm nervous system. Mm-hmm. Only when that nervous system is calm could I access these deeper, more painful experiences and navigate them. And so that, I have lived that. Mm-hmm. And it's the same is true with 2B Magnetic that I mentioned earlier. Their work with, they do some hypnotherapy tracks or meditation tracks that are helping you get to your brain to a neutral state. And they say, look, if you want to process inner child healing or all of these different wounds, they have these meditation tracks that walk you through that. But if you're triggered and activated, that's not the time to go toward those. You need to go toward the ones that are calming your nervous system first. And then we can work into digging into the deeper work. So that tracks across anything that's healthy says triage first. Take care of the brain, take care of the body, and then dive in.
Yeah. Right.
So you would tell that to somebody that they need to, one, tell somebody.
Right. Get support.
Yeah.
I love therapy. I love, and you know what? You don't necessarily have to do traditional talk therapy.
Right.
There's support groups.
Absolutely.
There are 12-step groups that address it. Parenting support groups for people who've lost their children.
Mm. Divorce recovery groups.
This grief therapy group that I went through.
Yeah.
Through the recovery handbook. Yeah, there's lots of different options out there, but you just got to ask and ask questions and maybe even be open to experimenting with things like EMDR.
EMDR, somatic workshops, breath work, meditation. There's so many.
Yoga.
Yoga. Oh, I love yoga. And I want to have somebody that I have that will come on and talk about the somatic aspect of healing and how that can affect grief. And mm-hmm. it's a modality of self-care. Like you said, you've got to prioritize self-care in healthy ways.
Mm-hmm.
And did you ever get back to running or swimming?
Have you? No.
No. Okay.
I got into backpacking and
That's
hiking.
That's right. Yes. I saw your picture. Yes. Yeah. Okay. So nature lover, fellow nature lover.
Yeah.
So you took up backpacking.
Yep.
I love that.
It's, that's a secondary passion. And there's a great story behind that too, with my daughter and I were going to have in 2017 when my friend died, Katie and I decided we were going to have life-changing an event and walk the Camino de Santiago and cross Spain. It's 550 miles.
Wow.
And it was going to be a mother-daughter bonding experience. And we bought all our gear and got everything. And then I broke my leg. So
stop it.
This is a God thing, though. It was a God thing because...
Tell me more.
Yes. Katie needed to do that walk by herself. Katie is incredibly intelligent. She is my alter ego. She's a better version of myself. And yes, I'm codependent with her. And yes, I live vicariously through her. So, but after college, instead of going to law school, she decided to move to Ireland and wait tables for a year and travel Europe.
I love that.
And then... She did that for a while. She came home and was kind of lost, and I was lost. And that's when we decided to walk the Camino.
Mm.
And so her going to the Camino by herself helped her set the path from there on out. It was a great experience for her. And she said to me at some point, because she's like, you couldn't have done this anyhow.
Excuse me.
Because my plan was I'm going to heal. I'm going to be the best patient ever. Do all my physical therapy. And then I'll walk it in the fall. Or I'll meet you for the last 100 miles. Yeah. And she's like,
last 100 miles.
No.
Yeah.
You're not going to make it.
Yeah.
She goes, maybe you want to try an easier hike like the Appalachian Trail. And I didn't know much about the Appalachian Trail. I thought it was kind of like the Camino with hostels and food along the way. I didn't realize it's as rugged as it is.
It's very rugged.
So I didn't do my first Appalachian Trail hike in 2017 because I believed her about not being physically in shape enough. Mm. But I did it the next year.
Yeah, you did.
Yeah.
And did you do the whole thing?
Oh, gosh, no. It's 2,200 miles.
Right. Okay, so you did a section.
I do a section every year. The first year, I did 70 miles. My son helped me park my car at the 70-mile mark, and he drove me up to mile one, and I
northbound, southbound?
Northbound.
Okay. Is that Georgia? That's out of Amicalola State Park?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. I have a blog excerpt about it. It was...
Well, I'll clearly have to link that in the show notes, too.
It was the hardest thing I've done besides having children and driving nonstop from Alabama to Minnesota. But it gave me the hook, and it really, I think it's a healthier thing than me training for a marathon. I don't know if it is or not. Hmm. But, so I've given up running, and I've started backpacking. It is... And I also, too, love travel.
Yeah.
I've done a lot of traveling with my kids. I'm very blessed that one of my sons works for an airline. So I travel
a lot.
Quite cheaply.
That's awesome. Like the buddy ticket?
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
I'm
jealous. So happy for you. So happy for you. Also jealous.
But in a way, that's one of my coping mechanisms, too, like to push through tough deadlines, tough times at work. I'm like, oh, I got that trip planned.
Which is a beautiful coping.
Yeah.
That's beautiful. I've said that for one of my very good, couple of good friends heard me say over the last 3 weeks, this trip to the beach that I took this last weekend was like, that was it for me. I was hanging on by a thread for getting that respite at the beach. And it ended up being the most amazing time. But it was like for 3 weeks, they're hearing me go, if I can just make it to this weekend,
I will have
that respite. That's beautiful. I love that. I have so many. I have an embarrassing, my first ever backpacking trip, but that's for another time. But I love that you do that. I love that you, and the self-care of that, of finding what you're passionate about and just pursuing that is great to see. I'll definitely link that in the show notes.
It definitely, it's both a physical and an emotional challenge.
Oh, absolutely.
So.
And doing it, and you hike by yourself.
I hike by myself.
Yeah. Which in and of itself, I mean, I know that is lots of questions about that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's good and bad things. There's no bad things about hiking alone. The Appalachian Trail is so heavily
hiked.
Ma'am,
do you realize there are bears in those woods? Like, that's my biggest fear. Sorry. I interrupted you, but I had to say there are bad things about hiking, and they're big and have gnarly teeth, and I have irrational fears about bears.
I've seen plenty of bears.
See?
But I carry bear spray. My kids bought me bear spray, I think. I can't remember if it was the first year or second year for Mother's Day.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you got...
So, I've learned to carry it.
Yeah. It is a beautiful thing. I have some more fears to overcome before.
Yeah.
But I said this... My second-born son was going to be... I've said I've wanted to do... A full hike through.
I would love to.
And
do that.
Yes, and my son was like, "I'll do it with you in college." I'm like, "Dude, I can't even get y'all to hike 3 miles with me over here at Oak Mountain State Park." I know. I'm backyard is Oak Mountain State Park, and they're like,
"That's
you
where
want
I train."
Even? Oh yeah.
Yeah.
We'll see. We'll have to hike together. Okay. So. See. Sorry, guys. Thanks for coming to the show. We'll take it from here. Janice, thank you so much for coming and talking to us about this. I just want to ask if there's anything parting that, like, if I had one more thing to say or one more encouragement or anything you wanted to part with before we head out.
Well, I know at my lowest point, I didn't have much hope or belief that things were going to get better.
Yeah.
But it did. So my biggest thing is that it can always get better. Never lose hope. And if you can't drum it up in yourself, find someone like me or like Rachel who's been through what you're going through and has gotten to the other side. Because if they can do it, you can do it.
Absolutely.
Hope is the best tool there is.
Thank you for saying that. I appreciate you ending on that note. That is beautiful. And absolutely, for everyone listening, if you need any support, you can reach out to me. Janice, I'll have her Instagram information on there. You can reach out to her, all of the ways you can find her, her book, and
blog.
And blog.
Yeah.
And you've got lots of support. All right. Well, thank you for being here. Thanks, everyone. We'll see you on the next episode.